When victory hangs in the balance, you cannot afford to have 1% or 2% sitting out.
What will election conspiracy theories mean for the midterms? It's Thursday, October 6th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. There's just about a month left until Election Day. If you're voting absentee, you might already have your ballot. We've got people out reporting, and we're looking at the state of election systems in a few key states this year. Soon, you'll hear from Pennsylvania and Arizona. But first, Wisconsin. I was just up in Green Bay, where both major political parties say they're finding it easier to recruit people to become poll workers and to become poll observers who watch for potential rule violations. Former President Trump's baseless claims of widespread fraud have made election administration an issue in races big and small. And in Green Bay, that distrust has bled into nonpartisan municipal races, too. With outside money sowing distrust about elections ahead of the midterms next month, election officials and poll workers are trying to restore faith in the system. People like municipal clerk Celestine Jeffries. She showed me a back room in Green Bay's City Hall where they store a lot of the raw materials for putting on an election.
And this is, it's like I said, it's a little messy. Our election prep area. So all the ballot sleeves and highlighters and stickers. And for the kids, we have future voter stickers. Yes, that's for November.
In Wisconsin, elections are administered and funded at the local level. Jeffries is one of more than 1,800 municipal officials across the state in charge of running them. Maybe it's because her son recently got married, but she says setting up the city's 27 voting sites reminds her of wedding planning.
Polling locations are like 27 little mini weddings happening where every place is slightly different. Every place needs slightly different accoutrements. And so just making sure that everybody has what they need on that day.
They're making adjustments after the busy August primary when 15 polling sites ran out of ballots. But she says there were no major issues. Jeffries expects about 10 to 15,000 absentee ballots to come in between now and the end of voting on Election Day, in total about a third of the votes cast in Green Bay. So far, so good, she says. But with high turnout expected in November, she needs more help.
I need 75 more poll workers. I always need poll workers, though.
By law, those poll workers have to be evenly split between the two major political parties or unaffiliated with either. Jeffries says most are unaffiliated. But this year, local Republicans have a record number of people signing up to be nominated. That's according to Jim Fitzgerald, chair of the Brown County Republican Party. I meet him in his office outside Green Bay, where volunteers are popping in to pick up candidates' yard signs.
All right, good to see you.
Good to see you.
He says in addition to poll workers, they've also trained a record number of election observers, volunteers who watch poll workers for potential rule violations. Observers have to sign in, wear a badge, and stand in designated areas at polling places so they can hear and, quote, readily observe all public aspects of the process without disrupting the activities, according to state law. But Fitzgerald says Republicans are not trying to influence the election by intimidating Democratic voters.
Heck no. I mean, shame on us that we didn't do a better job providing poll workers and poll observers in the past. It's just now that we're starting to take seriously the role we play in the voting process.
Still, it's no coincidence that Fitzgerald's having an easier time recruiting. Trump is still spreading baseless conspiracy theories about the 2020 election, and the lies are energizing some voters. The Republican National Committee also has its own multi-million dollar effort to register poll workers and observers nationwide. But Fitzgerald says the Republican push for more poll watching is about restoring trust in the system and hopefully converting election denial into Republican votes.
Would I have liked to see Donald Trump as president? You bet I would have. But the facts are that Joe Biden is the president, by whatever means. Now, if I didn't like the means, then I got to be part of a change movement. Here's what I'm worried about with the people that are deep into the conspiracy, that they're going to sit home. And when victory hangs in the balance, you cannot afford to have 1% or 2% sitting out. You just can't.
Ken Glowacki of Green Bay won't be sitting out. He's 70 years old and says he's voted in every election since he was 18. This year, he also became an election observer. He's an independent, but was recruited by the local Republican Party at a showing of the pro-Trump film 2000 Mules, which purports to show evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. Glowacki says he was hearing conspiracy theories about the election and wanted to see the process for himself.
I could either sit on the sidelines and try to sift through all of the chaff that's flying around from everybody, or I could just get involved and see for myself.
November will be his third time observing, after April's municipal elections and the primary in August.
There were very, very nice chairs, and they were set up so you could see everything. There was no intent whatsoever to hide anything or anything.
Glowacki says he feels better about his local elections after seeing how it's done, but he doesn't have the same confidence in elections statewide.
I can only talk to the wards that I observed. Can't jump from there and to say, oh, throughout the state it was perfect. Who could make that stretch?
Multiple audits and court cases in Wisconsin found no widespread fraud in the 2020 election. And after losing the state to President Biden by less than a percentage point, Trump's campaign paid for two recounts. The results? Unchanged. Still, the unfounded claims of fraud have stirred up lasting distrust among many Republicans. In Green Bay, some of that distrust solidified after the municipal elections in April 2020. It was just a few weeks into the pandemic, and the city was struggling to fund its election. They cut the number of polling places from 27 down to just two. One of them was here at Green Bay West High School, where I meet City Councilman Brian Johnson. He says it was a chaotic scene.
Yeah, the line wrapped around the building down the block.
Green Bay was one of many cash-strapped cities that accepted grant money from the Center for Tech and Civic Life, a nonprofit backed mainly by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, to do things like buy PPE and pay poll workers dealing with a flood of mail-in ballots. That set off a series of conservative lawsuits that continued up until a few months ago. None of the cases found any evidence of wrongdoing, but Johnson blames some of the lasting distrust on the appearance of outside influence.
It's okay to acknowledge that mistakes were made without saying that the election was stolen. I think that's where a lot of the conspiracy dialogue comes from, is when funding comes from an outside source, we just need to avoid that dialogue by making sure everything that we need is fully funded.
Wisconsin Republicans are pushing a constitutional ban on private grant money to help administer elections. Campaign flyers in Green Bay call on Republican voters to ban Zuckerbucks, but some officials worry the proposal could make it harder to fund elections. Political groups, on the other hand, don't have any problems finding money. Ironically, since 2020, outside money has rushed into Green Bay to influence local races in the name of election integrity. Some ads pushed debunked conspiracy theories in the weeks leading up to this year's nonpartisan municipal elections, like this one from the Conservative Restoration PAC.
Free and fair elections are the Wisconsin way. Green Bay's leaders changed all that.
The left-leaning Open Democracy PAC also bought ads calling on voters to keep Wisconsin elections fair, secure, and accessible. Johnson, who considers himself a political moderate, says the conspiracy theories have tainted an otherwise legitimate conversation about how to run local elections.
We saw more PAC money being funneled into city council races than I've ever seen before, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it became an issue of, you know, election integrity versus threats to democracy.
Despite the distrust, the vast majority of people who actually work elections have the utmost confidence in them. I met up with a few poll workers at the Bay Beach Wildlife Sanctuary in Green Bay, one of the city's polling sites. Wild turkeys strolled around us as we chatted outside the visitor center, where polling booths will be next month. Dawn Smith has been a poll worker for more than 10 years. She's not affiliated with the political party, and she runs the polling site at St. Paul's United Methodist, which also happens to be her church.
It is very, very easy to complain about election fraud and shady poll workers on Facebook. It's a lot more difficult to come to my polling place where I'm working when I'm your neighbor and to complain to me that I'm a shady poll worker, because I would welcome anybody else to come and take my job. I mean, feel free, absolutely. We need the poll workers. I welcome you to come and observe.
She says the observers have not been a problem, but she's short-staffed, and a high turnout election next month could be overwhelming, because she'll have to attend not only to the needs of voters, but also address the possible concerns of poll observers.
I haven't had an issue with my observers being disrespectful, but I also go out of my way to make them feel welcome. We give you a nice cushy chair, and my people are nice, and I will do my best to answer all your questions. Now, November is going to be different, because in August it was busier than we were expected, but I had the time to walk people through and to, you know, to show them what they needed to show and answer their questions. In November, it's going to be crazy busy.
Denise Hutchison is also a poll worker in Green Bay. Like Smith, she's unaffiliated with a party. And she also wishes more people swayed by conspiracy theories about voting would get involved and see how the process works.
It's a very safe, it's a very good process, and yet there's a segment of the population that want people to believe that it's not. And we need to believe in our voting process and engage in our elections. And that's what I really want to see this November, is people out there participating in the process.
Hutchison will probably get her wish. Turnout is expected to be high in November, with competitive U.S. Senate and governor's races on the ballot. Add to that a national push for more poll observers, and there's likely to be more pressure on poll workers like Hutchison to make sure the gears of democracy keep turning. Of course, it's not just Green Bay. These same issues are playing out across Wisconsin. Tomorrow, we'll hear from folks in other parts of the state about how that race for governor could change how elections are run in Wisconsin.
You're going to see, I think, a foot on the gas pedal in terms of new election laws if Tim Michaels is elected governor, and probably continued stalemate and lawsuits if Evers holds on.
After the break, water and power is coming back on in the parts of Florida devastated by Hurricane Ian. But it's expected to take longer in the state's poorest communities. Stick around. Natural disasters don't discriminate, but disaster recovery does.
In fact, FEMA's advisory council warned about inequity in disaster relief 2 years ago. Chauncia Willis has been aware of the problem for a long time. She's the former emergency manager for Tampa, Florida, now the CEO of the Institute for Diversity and Inclusion in Emergency Management. Chauncia, welcome. Your crews are out in neighborhoods where many people are underinsured, where they're likely to have a hard time applying for and getting money from FEMA. What are you seeing and hearing from folks?
I would say that when we're going into these communities, we are seeing the impact that has occurred that is not proportional in some ways to the more affluent areas. And I'm trying to say it in a way that won't point any fingers, but I will say that the communities are expressing outrage because we see the same communities every time that have not been prioritized. If I go into certain areas of the counties, the water has receded. And, you know, but when I go into these other communities, such as Harlem Heights, the water is still there. I was driving my truck through flooded waters. And I'm asking, why is there still flood water here? Why haven't temporary pumps been provided to this community? And the residents are very clear. They will tell you this area floods all the time. And our homes haven't been elevated. Our homes haven't been provided with funding to make them more resilient.
And of course, this is a story as old as this country, right? I mean, FEMA acknowledges that its system of helping people after a disaster has been harder to access for vulnerable communities, for communities of color. Last year, for the first time, it said it would start tracking the race and ethnicity of people who are applying for disaster relief. But it sounds like what you're saying is that those changes or that acknowledgement didn't come in time for many communities in Florida.
We've talked to some local county governments, and they told us, they said, you know, we've been told to prioritize more affluent communities, not so much in those words, but in action. Essentially, get out there to those people, provide resources to those people, but we haven't been told, please make sure you're considering other populations that often are not prioritized.
Why? What's the argument? I mean, why would they say that?
It's just the way it's always been. The policy that all of us have been trained under as emergency managers is to do the most for the most. And so resources go to the most. Those who are those who are larger in number, those who are the easiest to get to, those who are, you know, already connected to government. But the challenge is, how do you get to those who are disenfranchised, who are not directly connected to the government?
This is a point that Vice President Kamala Harris was making recently when she said that equity has to be front and center in disaster relief. But she got pushback from people like Florida's Republican Senator Rick Scott, who said on CBS News last weekend that FEMA shouldn't treat people differently because of their skin color. Let's listen to that.
FEMA has to be colorblind. Mm-hmm. FEMA has to provide support to everybody.
So just what would you say to that?
I would say that he totally missed the people-first approach that she was supporting. Equity is about people. Equity is about treating people as people and not as acceptable losses.
You've been doing this work of disaster response for a long time, and you know the wrath of Ian is going to take, really, it's going to take years to fully understand. But when you look back at previous disasters, hurricanes like Katrina or Harvey, how have you been able to see firsthand how what we're talking about, inequity in disaster relief, how it plays out over time and the difference it makes?
Yeah, over time, I mean, those teams that are going out to provide those initial assessments of value and major or minor damage, if they haven't been trained to be more equitable, then we'll see what we saw in Hurricane Harvey, where the majority of denials for funding were in lower income neighborhoods. In some cases, before the inspectors actually went into a home, they denied it. The data is there. There is extreme disparity. All of that is exacerbated in times of disaster.
Chauncia Willis is the CEO of the Institute for Diversity and Inclusion in Emergency Management and the former emergency manager for Tampa, Florida. Chauncia, thank you very much for taking some time to talk to us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we speak with the energy secretary for Europe's biggest oil producer after OPEC's decision yesterday to cut production. Norway is turning on the tap to increase oil exports after the group OPEC Plus tightened their supply yesterday. And to talk more about what that means, we've got Norway's State Secretary for Petroleum and Energy. Andreas Bjelland Eriksen spoke to Scott Tong.
Can I ask you first about the news coming out of the OPEC Plus meeting to cut back production? We all live in a global market, so when the price goes up, we all pay that higher price. What do you think the impact will be on the price of oil? Crude oil to some could return to $100 a barrel.
First and foremost, it's not for me to comment specifically on OPEC's decisions, but I think obviously we live in challenging energy times. Prices are high. From a Norwegian point of view, we are very concerned with being a reliable, trustworthy, long-term energy partner.
And how do you read the motivation? In the U.S., there's a thought that this is intentionally trying to make life difficult for consumers.
That's not really for me to comment on. From our side, we're producing as much as we can. Mm-hmm. We're doing everything we can to maintain system at full speed going forward. Our position is fully concerned with being a reliable partner.
And I have read that indeed the Norwegian government's new budget plans an increase of oil production in 2023. How does all of this production square with Norway's long-made plans to move away from fossil fuel production?
I think what we've seen after the invasion of Ukraine is that the Norwegian supply of mainly gas, but also oil, has become absolutely detrimental to European energy security. We have increased production this year by approximately 8% with respect to gas as compared to last year. And I don't think that is sort of challenging the long-term common goal we all have to transition towards renewable electricity, but it's absolutely strengthening the position of the Norwegian continental shelf for Europe, for European mm-hmm. security in the short run.
So how can both of those, the short run production of natural gas and oil in this moment, how can that be consistent with long-term phasing out?
I think for gas, for example, we see that the alternative in the short to medium run is coal, which is much worse for the climate than Norwegian gas being delivered through already existing infrastructure.
Oh yeah, twice as much CO2 production from coal, approximately, yeah, compared to gas. Absolutely,
and therefore we see that the EU has a strong need for gas also in a post-2030 perspective, and I cannot really see that there are more natural areas to get that gas from than from the Norwegian continental shelf.
Norway is indeed trying to fill the natural gas void, given Russian exports have been shut down in the Ukraine war. Norway has opened a new pipeline to deliver gas to Poland, and it's upping its natural gas production. Despite that, will natural gas prices be very high for Europeans this winter?
I think what we see the effects of now is how Russia utilizes reduced gas exports as a strategic weapon to target European solidarity. And that leads to a lack of energy in the system, and with that, high prices.
Speaking of Russian exports, Russian natural gas, until it was cut off, flowed through the Nord Stream gas pipelines connected to Europe. There were explosions, as you know, along the pipelines. The U.S. government has called this sabotage. Does your government have any information on what happened, who did this?
Our neighboring governments are working very hard to look into what happened with Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2, and I think it's for them to comment on what has actually happened. I think it's important that we get the facts on the table to be able to evaluate this grave situation.
There were separately reports of suspicious drones over offshore oil production facilities for Norwegian producers just before news of these pipeline explosions. These drones, what can you tell us about that and whether they could be a sign of a significant threat to Norwegian oil production?
So obviously, I think we can say that in general, the focus on the security of the Norwegian production system and transportation system for oil and natural gas has increased. We have increased measures to be able to keep production running at full speed going forward. Obviously, I cannot go into details on what those measures actually entail, but from the government side, we are working closely with the companies on the continental shelf to be able to put in place necessary measures to increase the security within the system.
Andreas Eriksen is Norway's State Secretary for Petroleum and Energy. Secretary Eriksen, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you a lot for having me.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. We've got a lot more from our radio show at hereandnow.org, including why the idea of trickle-down economics just won't die.
With our budget cuts, we presented a complete program of reduction in tax rates. Again, our purpose was to provide incentive for the individual, incentives for business to encourage production and hiring of the unemployed, and to free up money for investment.
Today's stories were produced by Sam Rafelson and Lynn Menegon. Chico Theori, Todd Munt, and Jill Ryan edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike, Max, and me, Chris Bentley. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.